Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM-LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I'm a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research, development, and innovation. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our hundreds of past programs at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to promote public understanding of and support for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. Radio In Vivo is proud to acknowledge the underwriting support of our friend, Mr. Steve Brockman. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by Steve for the advancement of science and education. It's also a pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob Condor of Carolina Neuropsychological Service of Raleigh and Chapel Hill. Bob provides neurocognitive evaluations and neurofeedback for sports concussions and optimal sports performance. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Chapel Hill Eye Care, located at 235 South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill Eye Care provides comprehensive eye care to people of all ages. Healthy eyes for a lifetime. Chapel Hill Eye Care, 919-968-4774. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. It's been a while since we checked in on the science of toxicology here on Radio In Vivo, and is so often the case, there is a exciting and revolutionary new work being done in this field right here in the Research Triangle. This area is, of course, home to the National Toxicology Program, the NTP, which is part of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, both of which have their headquarters in Research Triangle Park. NIEHS is, in fact, the only one of the 27 institutes and centers of the National Institutes of Health that is not based in Bethesda, Maryland. The big news in toxicology today is the advent of so-called computational toxicology, which has been defined in the literature as a vibrant and rapidly developing discipline that integrates information and data from a variety of sources to develop mathematical and computer-based models to better understand and predict adverse health effects caused by chemicals such as environmental pollutants and pharmaceuticals. Now, that's a mouthful, but hang with us because you will totally understand all that in just a few minutes. Basically, scientists in the field are working to figure out how to change the current approach used to evaluate the safety of chemicals. Computation toxicology researchers integrate advances in biology, biotechnology, chemistry, and computer science to identify important biological processes that may be disrupted by the chemicals. We are very fortunate to have an accomplished practitioner and researcher in computational toxicology with us today. Dr. Nicole Kleinstrewer is a senior staff computational toxicologist at a company called Integrated Laboratory Systems, or ILS. ILS is a contractor for the organization known as the National Toxicology Program Interagency Center for the Evaluation of Alternative Toxicological Methods, or NICETM. Nicole is the director of the ILS NICETM Computational Toxicology Group. Her research focuses on in vitro or cell-based alternatives to animal testing, high-throughput screening and multi-dimensional data analyses, and mathematical and computational modeling of biological systems and their susceptibility to environmental perturbations that may result in adverse outcomes. If that sounds complex, it is, but never fear, we will unravel all of that and more in the hour ahead. Nicole received undergraduate degrees in mathematics and biomedical engineering from UNC Chapel Hill, and her PhD in bioengineering from the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand. Before joining ILS, she completed her postdoctoral training with the EPA's National Center for Computational Toxicology. Nicole Kleinstuer, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you, Ernie. I'm delighted to be here.
Nicole, to put the science in context for our listeners who may not be familiar with the field, tell us first about how computational toxicology differs from traditional toxicology.
So traditional toxicology really relies on animal-based test methods. So these are known as in vivo test methods. So traditionally what happens is you have animals in a controlled laboratory environment, and you're querying a specific type of toxicity, be that developmental toxicity, reproductive impairment, or development of cancer. And so you have relatively low throughput, high cost animal-based test methods where you do something like feed rats a certain amount of pesticide every day for a certain length of time, and then you evaluate apical endpoints. So apical endpoints are things like histopathology of specific tissue types, whether these rats are developing cancer in specific organs, or in the cases of like a prenatal developmental toxicity test, whether or not rats that are pregnant rats being exposed in utero will end up with things like birth defects in their pups. And so that's what traditional animal toxicology looks like. And it's certainly, you know, protective, and the regulatory agencies do an excellent job of interpreting this data and being very protective of human health and the environment. But it's very low throughput, and it's very costly, and from a lot of people's perspective, it's certainly morally questionable and ethically questionable.
In terms of the animal use.
The animal use, sure. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And there's also been a lot of questioning in the last couple decades on whether it's truly scientifically relevant from a mechanistic standpoint. So humans are not 200-pound rats, and even though some of us act like them sometimes. But if we really want to understand how chemicals are interacting with human health and disease pathways, it stands to reason that we should be querying human targets, cell-based, non-cell-based. But to actually understand that from a whole organism perspective really requires complex integration of the data from those human cell-based targets. And that's where computational models come into play.
I see. So, part of the challenge, obviously, is there are a lot of experiments that you cannot conduct on living humans.
Exactly. Nor would you want to.
Right. Well, tell us a little bit more about some of the methods that are used in computational toxicology, such as high-throughput screening, for example. What exactly does that mean?
So high-throughput screening is a new initiative that was really born out of the toxicogenomics revolution. So we now have the ability to query the entire genome, and so a bunch of really, really bright people got together 10, 15, 20 years ago and said, okay, well, now that the science is evolving so rapidly and we have this ability to do things like genomic screening, what if we applied that to the field of toxicology? And so there's this initiative called it's TOX21, and there was an NAS report, the National Academy of Sciences, put out a report called Toxicology in the 21st Century, really calling for a paradigm shift in how we address toxicity testing. And the TOX-21 consortium was formed essentially as a response to that call for a paradigm shift. And TOX-21 is a partnership among federal agencies. It includes the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Institutes of Health, multiple NIH institutes, including NIEHS and the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, NCATS. Mm-hmm. And then also FDA is a key partner in this TOX-21 initiative. And what they've really set out to do is to identify human cell-based and non-cell-based methods that query relevant targets in key biological pathways. So pathways that govern normal biology, but also pathways that could be thought of as pathways of toxicity or adverse outcome pathways. And so the thought is, if you can query enough of those key signaling events, molecular or cellular level signaling events, and put them all together, you can get an overarching picture of how particular chemicals may be disrupting those normal biological pathways and causing adversity. And so the high throughput nature of that comes into play with robotics, essentially. So there's the TOX-21 robot that lives up in Bethesda, Maryland at the NCATS Center, and it works tirelessly 24 hours a day, almost 365 days a year, to screen chemicals. And so you have, essentially what that means is that you have traditional in vitro type assays where you have cells in a petri dish and you expose them to chemical. Well, this is the same sort of concept, but it's miniaturized and far more rapid. Mm-hmm. And so you have assays that have been scaled to be amenable to a high throughput screening format. So in general, that means 96 well plates minimum, all the way up to 1536 well plates. And so what that means is you can test hundreds, if not thousands, of chemicals in a concentration response format. So you start with very low concentrations, and then you test increasing concentrations of a particular chemical in the same type of assay or cell-based biological system. And then you look at different types of readouts, protein-level readouts, gene-level readouts, and then you use that to help you understand how those chemicals, you know, may be causing an increase or a decrease in a particular response based on increasing concentration or increasing exposure to that chemical. And so the high throughput nature of it is really, for the first time, giving us an enormous amount of data on chemicals that previously had really no data at all or very little.
Sure. Well, thank you for that excellent explanation of high throughput and some of the methods that are being employed. And it is pretty exciting, and the field, it seems like the field is progressing rapidly and robustly. These methods that you describe, and there are several of them, and some of the ones that you've helped to develop in the computational world, do you think they've progressed to the point where they're ready for prime time, if you will, where they're ready to really completely replace the traditional toxicity testing, which I think everyone is ambitious to do that?
So in some cases, yes. It's certainly an area where we have to proceed with caution, because one key feature that in vitro test methods and high throughput screening assays generally lack is metabolic capacity. So when a whole organism, like an animal or human, is exposed to a chemical, that chemical is immediately metabolized in the body to so-called, you know, daughter compounds, metabolites, and those metabolites potentially have very different bioactivity than the parent compound. And so that's a caveat that always has to be kept in mind when you think about actually fully replacing traditional animal toxicology approaches with in vitro high throughput comptox based methods. Comptox is, you know, shorthand for computational toxicology.
Indeed.
So I think that with that caveat in mind, there's certainly arenas where this work is ready for prime time and is in fact being used in prime time to make regulatory decisions. And that's not to say that exposure levels or regulatory limits are being set based on high throughput screening data. That's certainly not the case. However, high throughput screening data is significantly contributing to prioritizing the thousands of chemicals that are out there in the environment that lack traditional animal testing data. And they lack that data because it's just a resource issue. You know, there's neither the time nor the money to actually screen the thousands of chemicals that we're exposed to on a day-to-day basis in animal tests. And so now the Tox 21 initiative has screened around 10,000 chemicals in about 60 different assays. The ToxCast initiative, which stands for Toxicity Forecaster, that is the EPA's sort of sub-research program that's a part of Tox21. Mm-hmm. And ToxCast really expands the biological space that's being queried there. So Tox21, you've got lots and lots of chemicals, smaller number of assays. ToxCast, you have a smaller number of chemicals. To be fair, around between 2,000 and 3,000 right now, actually, being screened in hundreds of assays, so between 700 and 800 or so targets across many different types of cells, ranging from human primary cells to cell lines to cell-free enzymatic biochemical assays, many, many different technology types, even including things like small model organisms like zebrafish or C. elegans, which are worms.
Sure.
That are, you know, have a remarkable amount of genetic conservation with you and I.
Indeed.
So are still quite informative. So that's an area where we're really getting a lot of information on a large number of chemicals where we didn't have information before. And this information is helping give us insight into mechanisms of toxicity, potentially mechanisms of adversity. And so the endocrine disruptor screening program is, I think, the area where this work is being used most rapidly and most, you know, in a regulatory context. So as I mentioned, there's about 2,000 or so chemicals in ToxCast. Several of those are about 1,000 of those are chemicals that have been deemed to be highly relevant to the endocrine disruptor screening program. So the EDSP, you have a question?
Well, I want to come back in much more detail to the endocrine disruptor
sure.
screening program and ToxCast and Tox21. We'll get into all those details. But I want to stay a little bit more general for
okay.
a few minutes. The newer methods that you have been describing, how reliable do they seem to be, or have they proven to be, in terms of the big issue, extrapolation to in vivo effects? Have they been shown to be reliably predictive of toxicity in humans and other whole animals? I know that's the big enchilada, isn't it?
Sure, absolutely. So it's really hard to answer that question with respect to humans.
Okay.
And what we really need, I think, is more communication between the toxicology field and the epidemiology field. So there is a lot of great work happening in epidemiology, but in a lot of cases, it's not necessarily driven by what's interesting as far as the toxicology community considers and what the regulatory community might actually need. And so I think there's a distinct need for communication between toxicologists and epidemiologists to produce properly designed and well-powered epidemiological studies that can then provide that kind of anchoring endpoint data to try and understand whether or not the in vitro bioactivity patterns that we're seeing in high-throughput screening research programs such as ToxCast and Tox21 are actually correlated with human health endpoints and human disease endpoints. So the human side is certainly more challenging and is going to require a lot more work. As far as the animal side goes, when we're trying to extrapolate from in vitro activity to in vivo toxicity, we use a set of analysis approaches called, appropriately, IVIVE, in vitro to in vivo extrapolation. And this uses things like physiologically based pharmacokinetic models that actually break down the body and the functioning of the body into sort of multi-compartments. So we can think of the body as just a big bag of water, or we can think of it as a big bag of water with several key organs that contribute to the distribution of chemicals in our bodies. And if we break it down that way, we can actually build remarkably accurate, you know, given the simplicity of the assumptions, remarkably accurate models that will actually predict if you eat X amount of a substance, or if you're exposed to X amount of a substance by injecting it into yourself or consuming it or rubbing it on your skin, how will that substance then distribute throughout the body? And what will be the concentration of that substance in your tissue of concern? So we can make predictions based on mathematical models, and then we can compare those predicted concentrations to the concentrations where we actually see activity in the cell-based assays. And you know, if we go through the long pains, and this really has to be done on a chemical by chemical basis, because these PBPK models that really predict the transport and the distribution of specific chemicals are dependent on the properties of each of those individual chemicals themselves. So dependent on things like binding to plasma protein or the hepatic clearance of that compound. But if we do it on a case by case basis, we actually see remarkable accuracy. We'll come back to EDSP, I know, but you know, that's one of the best examples where we have very good in vitro coverage of something like the estrogen receptor pathway. And so we can predict across, you know, by using information from multiple different assays and multiple different cell types that are all querying the same biological pathway, we can predict essentially a biological pathway altering concentration. And then we can compare that to a dose where we've seen that biological pathway be activated in an animal model, use a PBPK model to translate that dose to a tissue level concentration. And when we do, you know, our due diligence as far as really translating those concentrations and doses to the same playing field, they are generally within one or two orders of magnitude of one another. And given the amount of uncertainty that exists in the world, that's pretty much spot on.
And
that's where you start to see some really interesting things emerge with applicability domain of this kind of modeling. So you find out that there are certain chemicals for which this approach works really, really well. There are certain chemicals for which it works pretty well. And then there are others that it doesn't really work at all unless you start to consider things like extrahepatic metabolism, like glucuronidation, and ways in which that chemical is being broken down that may not be well represented by your model. But then it's an iterative thing, right? So you take your feedback from your animal, comparing your animal studies to your in vitro data. Oh, your model didn't do a great job. Why is that? Oh, there's this key biological process that's not being well represented. Mm-hmm. So then you evolve the model to represent that. And then maybe you can apply it a little more broadly to a class of compounds that operate that same way or metabolize that same way.
So this is really the computational part of computational toxicology, right? I mean,
yes,
the modeling is contributing to that, the efficacy of the extrapolation.
Absolutely,
that's exciting.
Yeah, it is. It is exciting. I mean, that's where The mathematical models, as you mentioned, are key for the in vitro and in vivo extrapolation. They're also really useful when it comes to data integration. So it's often quite challenging to take data from multiple different in vitro assays that are run in different cell systems by different companies, different technologies. Mm-hmm. You know, you're looking at luciferase as your output, so something glows if a particular protein is produced, versus you're looking at like a dimerization type endpoint or a cofactor recruitment, or just a pure binding assay. And even those all pertain to the same biological pathway, they're querying different points along that pathway. And so the question then is, well, can I just average them all together? Is that sufficient? Or is it more intelligent to go about it in a way that's actually driven by the biology and build something like a pathway-based mathematical model that predicts the activity of a chemical against the entire pathway as essentially sort of a weight of evidence of all of the different pieces of information that map to those different parts of the pathway? And that's another area where the computational modeling comes in really, really handy. And then I would say a third major area that we haven't talked about yet is on the front end. So we do a lot of work with quantitative structure activity relationship modeling. And
so called QSAR.
QSAR, exactly. There has to be an acronym for everything.
Of course.
And that is a particularly attractive field because it doesn't require any testing. All it requires is a characterization of the structure of your molecule and a reliable QSAR model. So to build a reliable QSAR model, you need a large data set. So you need, ideally, you know, thousands of compounds where you know the structure of the compound, and a library of so-called molecular descriptors, which could just be parts, little fragments of the structure, or they can be more complex, or they can include things like physicochemical properties. And then a data set to train that model against, where you understand what the activity of all those compounds is, you know, in an in vitro assay system or even in an animal. And then you can build a computational model using things like machine learning approaches that, when you have a new chemical and all you know about it is the structure, you can use those structural descriptors and that structural information to predict what the bioactivity of that chemical might be. And then, you know, if you have a new library of chemicals, so if you want to predict out the entire universe of chemical space, you can much more effectively prioritize that chemical space for further testing by using these QSAR models, which we call in silico. So you have, you know, your in vivo in animals, in vitro in cells, and then in silico is, you know, existing in that ephemeral computational space but it's a really effective prioritization tool.
I see. Wonderful explanation. I appreciate that. I wasn't quite sure of how that all fit together, but you handled it quite well. Nicole, I'd like to transition for just a minute to talk a little bit more about the contributions of all this to reduction in animal use, because that is a major portion of NICEATM's mission.
Absolutely.
It exists largely to support, and we'll get into a little more alphabet soup here, support the efforts of ICVAM, the Interagency Coordinating Committee on the Validation of Alternative Methods, which is an interagency committee composed of representatives from 15 U.S. federal regulatory and research agencies. And that group is mandated to pursue new testing methods that reduce, refine, or replace animal use, which is known as the three R's. So computational toxicology is actually providing many of the new methods in that arena, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, the relationship between ICVAM and NICEATM has certainly evolved over the last 10, 12, 13 years. And it's a wonderful symbiotic relationship where we are able to work very closely with the representatives from the federal agencies to understand really what their regulatory needs are and also the framework within which they have to operate, whether that be a political mandate or a consumer-driven mandate. And so some of our partners, for example, from FDA or EPA or the Consumer Product Safety Commission, are really fantastic as far as helping direct NICEDM's research toward those areas where we can most effectively reduce, refine, or replace animal testing. And there's two key areas that I'm, you know, most heavily involved in where we've seen a lot of recent success and anticipate even more near-term success in replacing or reducing animal testing. And those are endocrine disruption, as I've already mentioned, and we'll talk more about that later, mm-hmm. and also in the areas of skin sensitization. And so that is really relevant most to cosmetics and personal care product testing. So clearly, if we're going to be, you know, smearing creams and lotions on our skin, we want to have some assurance that it's been this ingredients in this product have been tested for their potential to cause an allergic reaction. And this is called allergic contact dermatitis, also known as skin sensitization. And there's been enormous amount of work over the last decade or so to evolve from older testing methods, which use the guinea pig, to what's called a local lymph node assay test, which uses mice. And then NICEDM and ICVAM participated and actually led the effort to create what's called the reduced LLNA test, which reduces the number of animals that are necessary for that in vivo test. Mm-hmm. But now, within the last few years, there's been an initiative spearheaded largely by the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is a group that really is in charge of globally harmonizing test guidelines and test methods, to develop in vitro assays and in vitro test methods that will, when combined, predict skin sensitization potential and potency of particular compounds. So there's been, you know, a real move, a real shift away from this idea of one-to-one replacement. Initially, people thought, oh, well, if I can find that magical in vitro cell-based test, I can find this one test that will replace this animal test. And now it's becoming clear that what's really most useful are things that are called integrated testing and decision strategies or integrated approaches to testing and assessment, ITDS, IATA, whatever your favorite acronym is. There's subtle differences between them, but essentially they all mean the same thing. Pulling together multiple in vitro methods that, again, query different parts of the biological pathway. Mm-hmm. So in the case of skin sensitization, you have an in vitro assay that measures binding to skin proteins and reactivity. Then you can have another one that measures something like oxidative stress production, something that measures the activation of monocytes, and so the T cell response, the immune response. And those all are essentially steps in a progression down a biological pathway toward this adverse outcome of, you know, a skin allergic response. And so we and others have investigated ways to combine those data streams either in a very straightforward decision tree type approach or in more complex approaches like machine learning approaches like support vector machine algorithms and things like that to create these integrated testing strategies that will allow regulators to decide if a compound has the potential to be a skin sensitizer or not. And further, if a compound has a potential to be a very strong skin sensitizer or moderate or a weak. And there's a lot of progress being made right now especially in Europe, where there was this ban on animal testing of cosmetics ingredients that went into effect in March of 2013. And so they're really under a mandate to come up with a non-animal based testing strategy that will allow them to continue to bring new products and new ingredients into the market without testing in animals. And so there's an enormous amount of progress that's been made in that particular area.
That's great to hear. You are listening to Radio In Vivo, and my guest today is bioinformatics specialist Dr. Nicole Kleinstruer from ILS Incorporated, contractor to the National Toxicology Program Interagency Center for the Evaluation of Alternative Toxicological Methods, or NICETM. And before we let any more time get away from us, I want to congratulate Nicole, who just informed me that she's going to be changing jobs shortly, I guess in January.
That's right.
And Nicole is going to be the deputy director of NICETM, so she'll be an official Fed at that point. Congratulations, Nicole.
Thank you.
Now, tell us, you know, you've had quite a career at such a young age. How, with your particular educational background, it seems almost inevitable that you ended up in computational toxicology. Tell us a little bit more about your own progression and how you found yourself where you are today and where you're going shortly.
Well, first of all, I think it's hilarious that you refer to it as inevitable, because I actually never dreamt that I would end up in toxicology. Had I known that, I would have paid a lot more attention in my chemistry classes in undergrad. Since I thought, oh, who cares about chemicals? I care about math and biomedical engineering and creating mathematical models. And now my life is ruled by chemicals.
Indeed.
So I'm often relying on the incredible expertise that I have around me in terms of chemists and chem informaticists. But anyway, I have received some incredible training, and that's really why I am where I am, is because of the people that I've been lucky enough to work with. So first of all, my very first teacher and sort of the teacher that I'll always have was my father. I'm kind of like his mini-me. So he is a biomedical engineering professor and mechanical engineering professor at NC State University.
Okay.
He does an enormous amount of research in computational fluid dynamics and mathematical modeling, biological systems. So he really got me interested in that from a very young age. And so when I was coming up through Carolina, just down the street from here.
Go Heels.
That's right. I studied both mathematics and biomedical engineering with minors in physics and Spanish. And I really always envisioned myself going into academia, and I really enjoy teaching, and I really enjoy applied mathematics and trying to really understand the way the world functions, specifically biology functions, from the perspective of mathematics and engineering. And so I pursued a PhD in bioengineering. I thought it was going to be at Duke. It ended up being about as far away as you can go. I ended up in Christchurch, New Zealand. That was a series of serendipitous events that took me there. I took a year off between my undergraduate and graduate education to travel around the world with one of my girlfriends. And we had working holiday visas for both Australia and New Zealand. Spent a few months in Australia working on the Great Barrier Reef. Beautiful surroundings, less than intellectually stimulating work environment. I was working in retail. And so by the time we got down to New Zealand, I emailed my father and I said, please tell me, is there biomedical engineering anywhere in New Zealand? I would much rather be a research assistant for 3 months than a shopkeeper again. And so he gave me a couple of contacts, and we went down to Christchurch to the newly formed Center for Bioengineering. And I somehow convinced Professor Tim David, the head of the center, to hire me as a research assistant for a few months. And by the end of that time, we just had so many great ideas for projects that we wanted to work on together that they offered me a targeted international doctoral scholarship to stay and do my PhD there. And when someone tells you that they would like to pay you to do your PhD in the most beautiful country that you could ever imagine. It really mm-hmm. does look like Lord of the Rings sure. everywhere you turn.
Okay.
That's pretty hard to turn down. So so I stayed. I lived there for almost 4 years. It was a really remarkable experience. But it was also very far away. And I'm very close to my family and very much wanted to be back in the Triangle. And it's such a rich environment for science and technology and education that I didn't think it would be too difficult to find a position. And as it turned out, I stumbled into the absolute best postdoctoral experience I could have ever asked for. So I interviewed with the National Center for Computational Toxicology by video conference at around 4 a.m. New Zealand time. And they told me later that that's how they knew I was serious, because during the question and answer session, they noticed that the sun was rising behind me.
Wow.
So they thought, oh, she really does want to come here. She got up pretty early for this.
Indeed.
So I accepted a position in the virtual embryo group. So that was a really, really cool project, working on building computational models of developing embryonic systems to serve as sort of in silico testing platforms and ways to integrate all of the in vitro data on individual molecules by using our understanding of how those molecules work together. And so I had an amazing postdoc mentor. His name is Dr. Tom Knudsen. He's a developmental biologist, one of the most brilliant and kind people I've ever worked with. And I received a lot of really great training from him. But the other amazing part about that opportunity was the cross-training that I received from the other folks in the National Center for Computational Toxicology. So Richard Judson has also been an amazing mentor for me, and Keith Houck and Richard and all of the folks and Bob Cavalock and David Dix at the time were both there. And these folks all spearheaded the ToxCast initiative that we talked about earlier on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happened that when I walked in the door of my postdoc in August of 2009, I pretty much walked into a sea of data. It was right when the phase one of the screening for ToxCast had just been completed. All the data was just coming back in-house. And you know, we were spoiled for choice as far as all of the different data sets that we could analyze and what we could do with them and how we could start to build models to predict animal toxicity, to predict toxicity based on, you know, biological pathways that maybe hadn't been queried as well before, things like that. So that was absolutely an incredible experience. And I was able to work not only on the developmental toxicology aspect with the virtual embryo project and some of the vascular disruption work that we might talk about in a minute,
mm-hmm.
But I was also able to work on things like cancer signaling, understanding if there were chemicals that seemed to be specifically targeting hallmarks of cancer. So things like deregulated immune signaling and evading apoptosis and overblown angiogenesis. And, you know, were there particular chemicals that were targeting these biological signaling pathways that could be contributing to the onset of cancer or the promotion of tumors? So I really got to work on a number of different projects that were really fascinating. And since I've transitioned over to ILS and the NICEDM group, I've continued all of those collaborations. So the EPA is, I would say, our biggest collaborator outside of NIEHS, outside of the National Toxicology Program, the EPA's Office of Research and Development with the CompTox Center, and then the Office of Science Coordination and Policy that runs the Endocrine Disruptor Screening Program. We work extremely closely with both of those groups and mm-hmm. count ourselves very lucky to be able to do so.
Well, let's go back, and you briefly touched on your work on blood vessel development in a paper you published in 2013 with your EPA colleagues. Tell us a little bit about that. And it was kind of a precursor of some of the larger studies to come, wasn't it?
That's right. So there were a couple papers that were published on that, one on environmental health perspectives, and then the computational model was published in PLOS Comp Bio, and then there was another model or another paper, more of a review paper that we published in Birth Defects Research. And all three of these papers and the whole project really focuses on the concept of one of the major mechanisms of developmental toxicity being disruption of embryonic vascular development. So the cardiovascular system is essentially the first organ to develop in the embryo, and it really provides oxygen and nutrients for all of the other developing embryo, all of the other developing organs and tissues. And so it's critical during every stage in development, from the very beginning all the way through gestation. And what we noticed on a first pass screen of the ToxCast phase one data, which was really aided by the fact that I would say 85 to 90% of the chemicals in the phase one screen are food use pesticides. And food use pesticides are subject to much more rigorous testing requirements than pretty much any other type of chemical. And so we had animal data for all of these compounds. We had, you know, prenatal guideline developmental toxicity studies. So we knew which compounds were causing developmental toxicity and disrupting embryonic development in rats and or rabbits for the majority of these chemicals. And what we noticed when we took sort of an approach that was driven by that data is that there was a real significant portion of those developmental toxicants, so those compounds that were disrupting development in animals, that also seemed to be targeting in vitro assays that really mapped to vascular signaling pathways. So key molecules, key cellular events in vascular development. And so there was this trend, and by no means would we think that all developmental toxicants would work via vascular disruption, but you can look at it the other way. If a compound is going to disrupt vascular disruption, you can be fairly certain that it will actually disrupt embryonic development and cause toxicity. Mm-hmm. And so we used an approach that was really informed by the body of scientific literature that exists on vascular signaling and vasculogenesis and angiogenesis and how that occurs in an embryo. And what are the key pathways? What are the key signaling molecules along those pathways? And it turns out we have very good coverage of those signaling pathways in ToxCast. And so we built what we call a putative vascular disrupting adverse outcome pathway. So we would hypothesize that chemicals that perturb enough of those key vascular signaling targets at low enough concentrations of that chemical could potentially pose a risk to a developing embryo, to a developing fetus, sure, by disrupting blood vessel development. And so we created what we call a signature. So these are the assays that map to these particular molecules, these particular signaling targets, and we can look at the overall activity of a chemical against those key targets. But then the other thing that we did was we created a computational model, and it's a cell agent-based model using a software called CompuCell 3D that was developed by some very clever physicists at Indiana University. And it's really a model that allows you to integrate the interplay and the co-regulation and the crosstalk between molecules that are shared by multiple biological signaling pathways. And then that if you can recapitulate the normal biology of early embryonic vascular development, in this case, the formation of the early embryonic capillary plexus, if you can adequately program your model to recapitulate normal biology, then you have a certain amount of confidence that when you try and disrupt your model based on the profile of a particular chemical against those individual molecular targets, that you're really getting a perspective on what would happen on the tissue level, including compensatory mechanisms. So maybe if you downregulate a particular signaling molecule, there are other signaling molecules that can come in and compensate for that. Mm-hmm. Or additive type effects. If you are downregulating multiple signaling molecules in a particular pathway, is that going to knock out that entire pathway? And that's not something that you would be able to tell from just looking at the individual data points. So the individual okay. data points that come out of the different in vitro assays. You need computational models to integrate those together and to get a picture of what happens on a tissue level.
So it was really a model in and of itself, or a proof of concept for predictive toxicology. Nicole, before our time gets too short, as promised, I want to come back to the Endocrine Disruptor Screening Program, or EDSP. Hopefully we've adequately talked about TOX21 and ToxCast and kind of set the stage. The EDSP is a EPA program which is benefiting from both ToxCast and TOX21 work. Give us a briefly, what are endocrine disrupting chemicals and why are they the cause of so much concern?
Well, the endocrine system is the hormonal regulation system that really, you know, maintains homeostasis and balance in your body. And I think that the reasons why they are potentially of concern are multifold. So that there's the concept that that particular system is always in flux. It's always maintaining a particular homeostasis, and it can be, you know, there's a lot of changes in estrogen and androgen and different types of hormones that occur even on a day-to-day basis. There's a lot of fluctuation in hormone levels, but then even more so cyclically for women, especially going through menstruation, but also pregnancy. There's and then for children going through puberty and development, there's a lot of fluctuation in those hormone levels, and that, you know, causes a lot of biological changes in your body. So I think it's one of the sort of areas of biology that we have a lot of, you know, normal changes in and different, you know, shifts that we would where we would expect it to be sensitive to, mm-hmm. you know, compounds that might come in and actually mimic natural endogenously occurring hormones.
Sure.
The other thing is that for whatever reason, and as I mentioned already, I'm not a chemist, so I don't know exactly why, but there's an enormous number of compounds in the environment that are actually structurally similar to, you know, endogenous hormones. So things like phenolic compounds, and they turn out to be also functionally very useful in chemical production, in different personal care products, and use as plasticizers or additives or preservatives. And they actually have enough structural similarity to some of those naturally occurring hormones and steroids that they can interact with some of the same receptors. So like the estrogen receptor, the androgen receptor, the thyroid receptor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really the motivation behind this political mandate, which is the Endocrine Disruptor Screening Program, which essentially states that the EPA needs to evaluate the endocrine disrupting potential of X number of chemicals.
And it's thousands.
It is thousands. I was just about to say the number varies depending on who you ask. It's anywhere between 10 to 30, 50,000, something like that. Mm. Obviously with varying exposure levels.
Sure. So that's really been a tremendous challenge for that program, those many thousands of chemicals. And I want to kind of jump to the chase here.
Sure.
Part of what computational toxicology has contributed to this is the increasing ability to screen those many thousands of chemicals.
Absolutely.
The first section of the EDSP, it was in the dozens, if I recall correctly.
That's right.
And now we're getting into the section of it where we'll be able to use some of the methods you've described to prioritize and screen the many thousands.
Absolutely. So there are 11 assays, a mixture of in vitro and in vivo assays in the EDSP Tier 1 screening battery. And only about 52 chemicals have been issued test orders and have been run through that screening battery. And because those are all low throughput, even the in vitro assays are low throughput, and they rely on things like rat uterine cytosol, things that are derived from animals. What we have done in partnership with the Comptox Center and the Office of Research and Development from the EPA, and led by the Office of Science Coordination and Policy with the EPA, is we have validated a computational model that predicts estrogen receptor pathway activity, so estrogen agonist or estrogenic activity against the pathway. It's built off of 18 different high throughput screening assays from the ToxCast and Tox21 battery. Mm-hmm. And we validated it against what's known as the uterotrophic assay. So the uterotrophic is the in vivo screening assay where rats are fed or injected with potentially estrogenic chemicals, and then the uterus is dissected out and weighed. And if they see an increase in uterine weight, it's an indicative of an increase in uterine cell proliferation, which is a downstream event of estrogenicity. And what we've managed to do is demonstrate that the in vitro assays are not only more reproducible, potentially more reliable, but as good, if not better, than the in vivo animal test in screening for estrogenic activity. And so as a result of that, in I think it was June or July of this year, the EPA put out a Federal Register notice and a series of three publications that we helped with or led that states that for the first time, a regulatory agency is accepting in vitro and computational approaches to screening for estrogenic activity as alternatives to the currently accepted regulatory guideline tests that rely on animals.
That's wonderful. That's very exciting development and a major real step forward in the field. Well, Nicole, we are out of time. It's been a wonderful pleasure having you on Radio In Vivo today. Please keep up the good and very important work. And best of luck for continued success, especially in the new job.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows. And we're also on Facebook, so have a look at our Facebook site. Please join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on Volunteer Power, WCOM-FM, Carrboro, and Chapel Hill. Now, to be sure to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. Thanks for listening, and we will catch you next time.